Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who make fine art with the needle and the thread and the cloth. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes. So, okay, paying job, other things getting in my way these days. So I've been forcing myself to get like 15 minutes of stitching in at the minimum.
Yeah. I feel it.
Yeah, because I feel I have momentum with this sampler, and while I'm waiting for my Sarah Brazier sampler materials to come, I want to keep going, but I can't get 2 or 3 hours, and frustrating.
It's frustrating, yeah, because I've been working on this Debbie Rowley piece, and I really love it, and I really want time, and I think that's something probably everybody has. You know, you have to fight with that sometimes, is you just want some time to stitch and you just can't find the time, you know, and especially when you're, you know, sometimes you're on a piece and you're like, oh, I've been working on this forever and I'm just not interested in it anymore. But when you do have a piece that you're really enjoying and you know, you're enjoying watching it come to life and it's challenging and it's exciting and you feel like you're learning something and you're progressing and you're growing as a stitcher, it's hard to not be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So. Yep.
Very true. Yeah.
I feel for you.
Gets frustrating. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been other times, you know, where I have plenty of time, so I'm just hoping for that. I need one of those weekend days where I can get up in the morning, go for a bike ride, take a shower, and then there's nothing all right. The way to bedtime, you know?
You one need a rainy day so there's no guilt, right? Because then you can't do yard work.
Right. Yep. Because that's what's facing me Saturday is I need to do yard work. But, yeah, rain would be the gift, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, because then you can't do it.
Sorry, can't do it. Yeah.
Can't rake leaves in the rain.
Nope. I haven't checked the weather, but be my luck that it'll be a perfect 65-degree day with a little breeze out of the north, perfect for heavy garden work. Yes. Darn it!
Well.
But it always looks so nice when you're done, though, you know, so.
It does.
Yeah.
You know what else looks really nice? A finished sampler.
There. That too. That too, yes. So true. So true. All right, I'm pulling for rain Saturday. Mm-hmm. Lots of it. Yep. Had a discussion. We had, last night was the our Fox Needlepoint Guild meeting, our monthly meeting. I haven't been to one in 5 or 6 months, I think. Because I keep having to travel or have something else on the evening of that something else I can't get out of. And believe me, I'd try to get out of it if I could. But so I finally got to go last night, so it was great. And what in the show and tell section, because it's always business meeting and then show and tell and then program.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ladies had finished a cross stitch piece that she had wrapped around foam core in some way. I didn't ask if she'd laced it or how she'd done it. But she had found this wooden easel. It's about, 8-inch tall wooden easel at Target. And so she had put this in, and it has an opening cut for a photo or something and a back. And so she had put it in there, and it looked absolutely great. And one
That's
of those
a
things,
great
you,
idea.
Yeah. She said it was like $2 or $3 at Target, so I got to make my way to Target. But then I was talking to Connie Bell, a friend of mine, who is a member also, and we were talking about having, because we were talking about framing and the cost of framing, and then having something where you would have 4 or 5 different pieces of the same size that you could put into an easel or a tray or something.
Rotate.
Yeah, and just rotate them out. And that first thing I thought of was Debbie Rowley has a whole series of charts that go in a tray. I think it's one of the Sudbury trays. And so she has one for each season. But then it was this easel then was sitting over there that this lady had. And I thought, oh, yeah, think about having one or two of those easels. Because you could have holiday things or seasonal mm-hmm. things. And so then I got home and I started poking around. All right, what would you have for a series? You know, that would fit in there. And there's lots of options. Yeah.
I like it too. For even if, so you're, the way you're describing it, it sounds like the easel really is a picture frame that's sort of done up in the shape of an easel, right? So, but what would be neat instead or in addition is you could probably go to either to Target to get something similar or to just like an art store, like a Pearl Art is what we'd have in New York, but I don't know what it would be anywhere else, just to get an easel that's a traditional easel that you would lean a canvas on. And then you could not frame up things, but sort of do it up the way that your friend did, where she just laced it or put it up on foam core and then just displayed it like you would a canvas. So, and what's nice about that is it doesn't have to be the same size and shape at all. So if you wanted to do, like I'm imagining doing a stump work piece and then doing a different stump work piece where if you're doing designs out of a book or, you know, out of your own head, they're going to be all different kinds of shapes, right? So now that you're doing different surface embroideries, it's not a charted design where this is the size of the canvas and this is the size of, it's pretty much whatever you're going to be. Even if you take a design out of a book, it's, you know, you're going to trace it and it's whatever size you blow it up out of the, you know, when you enlarge it on a copy or something. So the size becomes irrelevant and then you could just kind of swap them out. You could really use it to just showcase anything. Right. And then if something didn't really appeal to you, the other thing that's really interesting about that is we tend to look at pieces very differently than the way that people look at them that are not us. And what I mean by that is this. Right now I'm looking at this piece and it's about 6 inches from my face and I'm looking at tiny little bits of it. And I never look at it as a whole. So unless you frame it and put it someplace where you are walking by or you're looking at it from a distance, you don't get to see it that way. And I think the benefit of doing so is you get to look at composition. So you and I think a lot of people will focus on, is this flower petal done perfectly? Is this wired slip neat or are there threads, you know, frayed or... you know, is the stitch pulled? Is the tension right? You know, we think about technique. We don't think about the artistry of it, right? And it's ironic because we keep talking about the fine art of needle and thread, but it's only when you take a step back or several steps back that you can look at the piece as a whole and measure, does the composition of this work? Do the colors work together? Is there too much of sort of mid-tone things and not enough very dark or very light? Is there balance? Is there too much balance? Is there too much symmetry? Do I make things too regular and I need to sort of branch into the irregular to make it interesting? Unless you take that step back, you're not going to ever get that. The other thing I think is important is one of the tricks I like to do with other things is put them away and not look at them, because you sort of become blind to them after a while. And if you have this easel, you can put a piece away, not look at it for weeks, month, and then put it back and then put it someplace where you'll happen upon it by surprise. And you'll see it completely new and fresh. And you'll see things that you didn't see before. And I don't mean technique pieces. I mean composition, artistry, all of those things. And you'll see things that you did well that you didn't notice before as well. So it gives you kind of an opportunity to evaluate your own artwork in a different way with fresh eyeballs. And I think that part of it to me is the most appealing part.
This is interesting. Because you got me thinking here. Yeah, because this thing that the lady had from Target was it was basically for a picture. It was like a sandwich board, You know, it was like 8 inches tall. But yeah, to get a small tripod artist easel, because see, I could put that at the end of my stitching table. And because see, what you all right? So I could things I'm working on, but also I have a couple of painted canvases. I could mount those on stretcher bars and put one up there. And then when I'm, you know, taking a rest from what I'm stitching, I could look at that and I could kind of mentally figure out what I want to do with it. Because right now they're put away. So and then I also like that having it in a living space where others might, you know, guests and whatever, as a place to just put your needle art unframed, a piece I finished that, you know, I just lace it over foam core or just leave it on the stretcher bars and just set it up there for a couple weeks and then change it to something else.
Yeah.
And that's cheap to do.
It is cheap to do.
Because those easels can't be that expensive. Yeah.
No, the easels are not going to be that expensive. And when you only need two of them, and you can swap things out. But I'm really enamored with this idea of putting it someplace unexpected that catches you off guard.
Yep.
Because that's when you're going to see things you didn't see before.
Yep.
Right? That's where I think you get the most growth. Because if you look at a piece all the time, you become completely blind to it, right? Like, do you ever paint a room and when you're painting it, you see, oh, I you know, smeared paint on the ceiling. I have to fix that. And within 2 months, you're completely blind.
Yeah, you don't even see it.
You never see it again.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right.
So this is that. You're being disruptive about it. So I would even perhaps take the easels and move them around, you know, put them someplace unexpected so that it would catch me and I would have to see it when I wasn't expecting to see it. And, you know, it's almost like when you blur your eyes to something, when you intentionally look at it without glasses or from a distance, I think you would see things very, very differently.
Yeah.
You know? You could also do weird things. Like, you could put them upside down.
I was just going to say that. I was just going to say, yes.
Because if it's upside down, you lose the context of something, right? So then it's a little bit less about composition and it's more about color, because your mind is not attaching weight to, this is a flower, it should be X. Now it's just a shape, and now you're clear to evaluate it from the point of view of composition and color and all of those things. So by twisting everything, you see them completely differently. And see, those are things that I don't think that I'm particularly skilled at, because I haven't really been formally trained in those things. And that's something I very much admire about people that have been, because they see colors and combinations of colors that I don't see.
Right.
So I love this idea of is sort of forcing yourself to see in a way that you don't normally, simply by making it a non-habitual act.
Right. Yeah, because now I'm thinking, all right, in the house, where would I put it where I would only see it occasionally? And so, like, our guest bedroom that I go into, you know, maybe twice a month for some oddball thing. And there it is. Or our living room. I never go in the living room. I usually go in the family room downstairs. So to have it in the living room, first I'd have to get clearance from the tower. But, you know, that would be a place. And that upside down thing, see, that's, you know, that's way, when you're taught to proofread, copy.
Yes.
For if you're reading for typos, for misspelled words, what you're taught is to read it backwards. Because then you don't read over things. And it's so that upside down would be the same thing. It disrupts
your mind isn't filling in.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Right. I would put it at the end of hallway.
Yeah.
You know, or like in a cabinet. You know, so someplace that you don't expect to see it. You know, at the end of someplace that it, for me would be far away, so that I would have to, all the colors would kind of blend together and I would see it as a whole as opposed to the individual elements. I think that would be kind of neat. I think this is interesting. I think it's an interesting concept to try to learn those things. And even if, you know, and I would love to have a teacher that would be able to explain these things better and say what is good and what is not good. I had a friend who is a professional comic book artist, and his entire job is doing covers. That's all he does. And for a while, until
yes, and you've shared some of those, and they're amazing. Yes,
they are phenomenal, right? And so for a while, until it became politically unviable to do so, he started a blog, and I forget the name of it, and it has some since become defunct for reasons which will become evident. What he was doing, and it was purely for this reason, was he was showing examples of bad art. And it wasn't for the point of saying, this is a bad cover, look at how terrible this artist is. That was not it at all. He would put a cover up, and he would say, all right, this is not a good cover, but this is why, right? Uh-huh. Because, you know, because the texture is wrong, because the colors are mushy, because from 20 feet away in the store, you're never going to see it. And he'd point out different things about it that if the person had done it differently, it would have made a phenomenal cover. And it wasn't that he was trying to make the person do art in his style, because his style is extremely distinctive and not very comic booky at all. He was merely trying to educate people, really. And, you know, of course, people, you know, saw their covers and would get upset. And the really good artists didn't take that at all. You know, they'd take it and say, wow, you know, they could take a critique and take it as critique and then right. use that and improve, right? But for me, as a non-artist, I learned so much because he would point out things and then I'd read them and say, oh, yeah, I can see exactly what you're talking about. Like, this is a big muddy mess now because there's too many lines going here. And my eye is not drawn to the thing that is, you know, what you really want to be paying attention to in this cover because of the way that it's drawn, right? So I would love to have that. Like, that sort of critique would be so neat to do.
Right.
You know what I mean? I would love to have that sort of instruction. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I don't know where to get that. And that's really art. You know, that's not particular to needlework. That would be, right. You know, anyone that has any kind of art background would be able to do that because those things are universal.
Yeah. And I wonder, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's obvious why he doesn't do it anymore. I'm sure he caught it wasn't worth it after a while. Yeah.
But, no, not at all.
And that's the trouble with that kind of stuff. Because to take, say, just for instance, if you and I had enough expertise that we would critique needlepoint designs or any stitching design,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If we were going to, you know, be honest each time, it wouldn't be long. We would offend a lot of people.
We would have no friends. Yes.
Right. So, yeah. So that's what helps though, because it helps you.
Right.
It helps you. For instance, in the context of your friend, you start to see things in a different light. But then,
yes,
you know, to put it in needlepoint terms, on a positive note, you would start to look at a design, and with a critique, you might say, "All right, I can see that. I'm going to change this design in this way
mm-hmm.
to address that concern. If it in fact bothers you, I'm going to change it in this way to improve it or make it more visually appealing to me based yes. on that critique." And so you could learn, right. yeah, you could learn from that. And then you would have a different piece come out of it that to your eye would be better.
Right. And I think the only opportunity we have now are juried competitions. And I
Right.
don't know that that's the sort of thing that you get. I'm sure that you get a little bit of, feedback as far as composition and color and things like that. But I think a lot of it will be technique and, how well the piece is executed,
Right.
as opposed to how well the piece is designed. Right. So, and perhaps that's just, where I am right now with what I'm thinking about is, less about technique, because I think technique, to me, technique is, and I could be completely wrong, and by all means, correct me. I think technique, if one puts enough effort into it and really, really wants to and is willing to do it, barring some, physical inability to do so. Of which there are many, because, especially as we age or things happen, sometimes your hands don't do what you want them to do, or your eyes don't do what you want them to do. Technique can be learned. You can practice something enough times that you can do it. But art, to me, is a lot harder to learn, because I think that there are certain elements of that are innate, that you have to have some sort of born ability to tap into, or it would be a lot harder to learn. For some people it's going to come very easy, and some people it's going to be a lot harder to learn. So I'm
Right.
fascinated with this idea of learning design, because to my thinking, I feel like technique is something that just is just a reflection of effort and time, and that's something that if I want to, I can do. And design is something I don't know if I can do. So I'm fascinated with the idea that, there's something that I don't know if I can do it, and I want to, or I
Right.
want to know if I can, perhaps. Maybe that's really the question.
Right. Well, see, okay, this is all very interesting because we've kind of wandered into this without doing it
A bit.
intentionally, but based on our conversation last week with Jill Venditulli, there's just art falling out of her head onto canvas
Right.
with thread. But then I had put in our notes for tonight and was going to do it in a different context, but this fits right in. Is I listen to Michelle Garrett's FlossTube videos. Listen to yeah, you listen to them. I mean, it's a
Right.
talking head thing, but she does a real nice job. And one of the things that she had said recently was she was quoting Mr. X Stitch or Mr. Cross Stitch, Jamie Chalmers, and he had said that if you buy a kit and stitch everything exactly as designed, you have a nice hobby. If you buy a kit,
Yes.
railroad all your stitches and make everything perfect, you're a crafter. And if you buy a kit and make changes, switch out the fabric, change colors, you're an artist. And so based on what we're talking about, and this is the other thing that you've done to me here, is I've studied a lot of photography, a lot of it. But I now that you got me thinking, I've never really sat down with a piece and explored it photographically. Is it composed well? Does it have an interesting focal point? Are there supporting areas? Are there areas for the eye to rest? I've never done that. I always just look at needlepoint as, well, would I like to do that? Yes. Do I like what it looks like? And is there a challenge to it? So now I have to go. Now I have to go back, and maybe I've been doing that intuitively, without. I just see it and like it, but I've never consciously applied that knowledge. So now you got me thinking about going back and just looking at and doing basically doing a critique.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a couple of different things going on there. It depends on why you do it. If you do needlepoint because we have to be careful not to attribute a value to any of those things, and to say that an artist is better than a crafter is better than what was the first one that you said is a hobbyist,
Hobbyist,
right? There's those three things don't have values that are better or
Oh,
worse than any of the other things,
no, it's what you want out
and
of
I
it,
think absolutely, and I think that there's a tremendous amount of overlap, because there are plenty of artists that pick up hobby pieces every once in a while because you just want to sit and mindlessly stitch. And right. because that's right. what you need at that time. Right. And that said, just because one is an artist does not mean that one is a good artist, right?
So, so true. Yes.
So, but I would also like to couple that with the fact that I think the difference between a crafter and an artist is one simple thing, and that is being fearless. Or, yes. Let me take that back. It's not being fearless. It's having fear. It's being afraid of creating bad art and saying, I'm going to do it anyway. So it's knowing that you're going to be afraid and feeling like, you know, this could be terrible, and accepting that it can be terrible and deciding to go forward. That's what I think is the difference between a crafter and an artist, is that you have to understand that it will feel like, you know, it's frightening. And maybe fear is a little bit of a strong word, but it's intimidating and you feel like, oh, I don't know if this is going to go well and it might be terrible and I'm going to do it anyway. That's the difference. That's really the only difference.
Yeah. See, and I would not attribute fear to that. Cause you've talked about that many times. I would not attribute fear to that. I would attribute just having an open enough mind and a willingness to just go for it. I think the fear comes. The fear comes if you don't.
Right.
And you're afraid of being wrong in someone's eyes. See it.
Correct. You have to be willing to produce something that is imperfect.
Right.
And you know, for a lot, it depends on a lot of how we're raised. You know, what happens if you make something that's imperfect? Are people going to laugh at you? Are people going to think less of you? Are, you know, it's all of these things that are built up in us by how we've lived our lives. It, you know, not to get too weirdly psychological, but that's really what it is, right? It's how we think about things based on how we've lived, right? So I have friends at work who have lived very privileged lives and have been brought up to think that everything that they do is going to work out, and they are very successful because they enter everything that they do assuming that it will go well, and it goes well because when you walk in with that assumption, generally it goes well. And then you have other people who never ever step out of that shadow of this is not going to go well because they've been taught that it won't go well. So you have to break free of that thing, and you just have to sometimes do the thing that, you know, you have to sometimes try something, and sometimes it's going to be terrible. And, you know, that's the thing that you have to just accept. And so, you know, we've been doing this for a very long time, and I've been promising to tell a story for a year and a half now. It might be time for that story.
Okay.
Have I ever told you, have I ever told you the story of Gernard the Ugly Snail? Bear with me.
I do not recall that story, no.
Okay. So this is an important story, and it sounds crazy, but bear with me because it plays into exactly this. So when I was starting to knit again, when my son was maybe 9 or so, and I had knit, you know, on and off. I was a crocheter since I was a small child. That's what my family did. That's what we did. I was never a good knitter. I was actually pretty bad at it. And I decided later, because there was all these amigurumi patterns, these three-dimensional knitting patterns coming out that were really kind of cool looking. And so I kind of wanted to try them. So I bought a book, and there were some cool things in there. And so Jeremy had said, oh, you know, I really like this snail. I want you to make this snail. It's just like a garden snail, maybe 8 inches in length with a big curled shell and a body and everything. So I said, sure. So instead of, you know, knitting a scarf like every other normal person, I decided to knit this three-dimensional snail. And it's just all increases and decreases and, you know, a lot of basically that's how you build this three-dimensional shape, is by adding stitches and taking stitches away and knitting in the round. And so every challenge, every possible thing you could do, you know, I was knitting on four different needles like you would do a sock, and there was not a single simple thing about this thing. But I said, no, I'm going to do it, and I'll learn all of those things along the way. So sometimes that works out really well, and sometimes it does not. And this was one of those times that it did not work out well. So I started with a shell, and that came out fairly well because I used a variegated yarn, and it looked, you know, it looked like a curlicue shell, so that's fine. And the body of the snail, really all it had to be was kind of a tube, right, because that's all. And then it would get stitched to the snail. And of course, my son is following along intently because he's really interested and he really wants this snail. And this was at a point in his life where he was very insecure, and he was very shy and timid and all of those things, right? It was a tough time, you know, and I think a lot of kids have a tough time at that age, you know? So he's watching me do this snail, and I finished this body, and it is vastly out of proportion to the shell. And for the life of me, I can't stitch it on in a way that resembles a snail in any way. I can't even think of what it looked like. There's no describing it. It looked like a plastic water bottle with a curlicue shell. And it was, I didn't want to invest a lot of money. So it was like the worst, cheapest yarn that I got at a hardware store, like literally. So it was bright green, and it was the ugliest thing I've ever made in my entire life. It was viciously ugly. So anyway, so we finished this. I finished this thing, and, you know, this is to be a gift to him. And I say, here's your, you know, this is your snail. And he looks at it. He's like, well, that doesn't really look like a snail. So, you know, what do you do as a mother in that position, right? You want to be able to say, I've made this beautiful thing for you because I love you and all these things. And it was one of those moments where like a light goes on and something comes from above and fills your head with exactly the right thing to say. And I said, you know, here's how it is. Not everything you do is going to go well. And that's not a reason to not do it, right? Because this snail didn't come out very well, because it was the first snail I ever made. And that's totally okay, because I still like it, because every time I see this snail, I think of what it was like to learn how to do it and what it was like to feel all the things I was feeling about you while I was making it, and how excited I was to be able to make something for you. And even though it didn't come out looking the way that I loved it to be and wanted it to be for you, it's special to me. And I know that the next one I do will come out better, and maybe only a tiny bit better, and maybe it still won't look like a snail, but it'll look a little bit better. And every time I do it, it's going to be better. And that's pretty much how all of adults learn how to be. And that's how they learn how to be adults. It's by doing things they don't really have any idea how to do, but they try them anyway. And then they keep trying and ask questions and find people that know how to do things. And then you just kind of shrug it off, and you have to learn that you don't have to get it perfect the first time. And that's all right, you know? And I was able to do that in a way that I kind of shrugged it off and wasn't disappointed and didn't throw it away. And I said, you know what? I'm proud of this because I learned something from it. And it sunk in with him. So that ugly Gernard, and he was like, I'm naming it Gernard, became such a symbol for us of the things that you have to try, even though you have no idea what you're doing, because sometimes trying is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he's like, and now I want an army of Gernards. So, yeah, and of course, and then I went on and did other things, and they came out much better. But that thing, that item, and I still have it, and it is a treasured family heirloom at this point. Because it is exactly that. It's that symbol of, you know, of you don't have to be perfect. That no one expects you to be perfect all the time. All that people expect you to do is to learn, you know? And that's really all it takes. Yeah. Is for you to do it. Failure is an option. Just fail quickly. That's all you need to do. And it was such a great thing, and I was so glad that it came out terrible, because for a child, I remember being a child and like watching my parents do things and everything they did was perfect. And you always felt like you couldn't measure up because, well, if I do it, it's never going to come out as well as they did it. Mm-hmm. And I know that my child will never have that feeling because he knows that I will screw up, you know, and say, wow, that didn't work at all. Okay, that's all right. And I'm going to do it again, you know, so he knows it's okay to not be perfect. And that was worth the lesson.
Yep.
So that's the Gennard the Ugly Snail story. So I think that it's worth trying things and then looking at them and evaluating them and not, you know, not obsessing over them, but doing the experiment and just kind of sitting with them for a while. And I love this idea of the easel because it's not a monetary investment and it's not permanent. And you don't have to look at it for the rest of your life. And you can take it down and put it somewhere else. And then you can come back to it 2 years later and say, wow, I've learned so much from that. And I've, you know, developed so much as a stitcher since I did that. So my only thing would be that on the back of it, I would want to initial and date it.
Mm-hmm.
So that I would be able to go back to it.
Yep.
So this whole idea, I think, is a really phenomenal idea. It's a great teaching tool.
Yeah, I think I have to get an easel. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. I think we all need them. You know, even for like doodle things. You know, doodle cloths where you're just trying out ideas. How do you know if the idea is going to work? You know, because your doodle cloth, you're just looking at it from, you know, right in front of you. You need to know if it's going to work at a distance. This might be the best idea ever.
Ever.
In the history of ideas.
Wow. Lofty.
Yes. So we're still in the midst of moving, so I'm not sure where Gennard is, but if I happen to find him, I will take a picture of it and send it. You will not recognize him as a snail. I will just say that, but
that's okay.
Gennard is very special.
Uh-huh. No, that's a great story, and you know, but that, because when we talk about fear in art, that's why it's part of that. Is why I don't think it's fear. I think it's a willingness to just go for it. Because how many pieces of art have you looked at and your head, you just shake your head and go, what? What is that? And what was the artist thinking? But then somebody else will come along and go, whoa. Look at that. That says this to me. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's different, but you can't have that fear as an artist of turning out something and expecting 100% approval. You have to be willing to have people go up and say, man, that's the ugliest thing I ever saw. And well, okay, maybe it is to you, but to me, it means something. Yeah. Yeah.
And with the things that we do, there's technique involved. So you also have to give yourself the grace of the fact that it's going to take some time to learn the technique to create it. You know, even a photograph, you can luck out and take a really nice photo. For needlework, you need to learn how to manipulate a needle and thread to be able to create something.
Yes.
You know, so there is a bit of a learning curve, and you have to allow yourself that. You know, before you even get into the design element of it.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. No, and I've been thinking after the conversation with Jill and then Michelle quoting Jamie Chalmers, I've been thinking about a lot about this needlework as art. And
yes.
And that, you know, where does it become art? And then that whole thing, if you change the original design, And, you know, when is it yours? When does it become art? Is there some crossover point that it becomes a piece of art that you created as opposed to executing what someone else created? And there's just lots of little nuances in there that are worth exploring. You know, is it, if changing the color, does that make it art different from the original? Maybe not. I don't know.
Right. And I think you'll get different answers from different people. Right. And I think that there's some subjectivity there. You know, some of those things people will agree. And then there's going to be some borderlands in there that people will disagree. And that's okay, because that's one of the nice things about art, is that it's all about opinions. It's not science, where it's calculated fact.
Right. Yep.
That's the fun part of it, is, you know, any kind of art, literature, it's all open to interpretation. And that's where the beauty of it lies, is that everyone has a different opinion. And the time discussing those opinions and learning from other people's perspective is, I think, part of the best part of the art.
Mm-hmm. Be interesting to get. Maybe we need Jennifer Reifenberg to come back and talk to her as a painter. How, you know, what goes through her head when people look at her paintings? And if she has the opportunity to hear what they say without them saying it, you know, like eavesdrop on them, how does that feel? Is she got enough spine, thick skin enough that, yeah, whatever you think, this is what I did, like it or lump it? Or does it bother her at times? You know, it'd be interesting to get into an artist's head when they hear unfiltered opinions of their work. You know, what is that? And of course, you know, really good artists, you know, what do they think? I don't know. Just
right. And how does that differ from, you know, a fair juried competition?
Yes. Oh, very much. Yeah. Yeah. From someone who really knows and can explain what they're doing, as opposed to somebody just saying, I don't like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because I'm imagining that is a lot more technique heavy as opposed to art heavy.
I would think so. Yeah.
It's how well executed is a piece as opposed to, you know, how well designed is the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And but I wonder.
And I wonder, yeah, you know, I just use Debbie Rowley just because she's top of mind. I wonder if she sits back. I wonder how she views that. We have to ask her next time how she views that. What when she creates something? What, you know, where does she lie? Is it a piece of needlepoint? Is it art? Is it somewhere in between? Is it done because it's the challenge of combining these stitches and these colors? You know, what does it become? How does she view it? Be interesting. Mm-hmm. And does she view different designs, and just picking on Debbie just because she's sitting there and she'll take it the right way. But does she view some designs?
Gail Smyrna, a lot of people, I think, would be worth asking.
Yeah. You know, are some designs an exercise in challenging needlepoint? Are some an exercise in, look what I can do with this thread? And are some attempts at really, truly being artistic? I don't know. We raise more questions than we answer.
Ah, that's the best kind.
Yes. Okay. Once again, you have my wheels spinning. Well played. Yep. All right. We have to do some Sarah Brazier stitch along, just housekeeping stuff. And then we'll wrap
up. Housekeeping.
So, well, it's housekeeping, which sounds negative, but it's not. So, when this is Wednesday, whether we're 4 or 5 away from 600 members, which is incredible.
Yes.
So very excited about that. So, obviously, by the weekend, we'll have 600 members. That's just for a thing where people have to buy the chart. You know, it's not like a free design or anything. people commit to this thing. 600 members in less than a month is, I think, is quite impressive. So, yay for that.
And from everything we can tell, it's not that easy to get any of the materials. So fact that people are still committed is
yep.
Also, I don't have linen yet.
Nor I. Can we safely say we have created through this a hobby-wide shortage of some linens and silk thread? Can we say that? I think so.
I think so. I had ordered from Needle in a Haystack, and they said, well, we don't have this color, and we're not going to be able to ship it until I don't even know when. And so I wrote back, and I said, honestly, I'm going to dye mine, so can you ship me anything at all, like whatever you have? they kind of sent me back a laugh. They said, yeah, well, we'll send you out whatever we have. So I said, because I'm going to color it, and it's going to be colored really, really dark. So whatever you have, I don't care. Send me your scraps as long as it's big enough.
Yep. Now, see, I'm going to do mine on Newcastle Platinum. And
very nice. And that's the 40. Is that the 40 count?
Oh, yeah. 40 count. Yep. With the silk. And Kim Young at Sassy Jacks, I forget what her last communication was, but my response to it was, hey, when you get it, when you can get it, it's fine. You know, it's fine. Yeah. So that's kind of fun in its own right that we have this. And that was part of why we made the start date of the Stitch Along the 6th of June to give time for this kind of thing. But already some people have started, and it's quite all right to start. You get your stuff, start stitching. But already some have started to stitch, and we're really seeing the beauty of this sampler already. Yes. Just in a corner. Somebody started in the middle with a bee or a butterfly. It was pretty neat, just right there on this massive piece of canvas, just a little bee or butterfly, whatever. So that's neat. So.
I think that's one of my favorite things is the debate on where are you going to start?
Yeah. I put that poll up. That's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Most people stop top left, but, there's some center starters who are going top left because, they feel like they have to on this one, but I'm sure it's like
for the border. Yeah.
I really want to start in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So,
yep. And get your charts. They're still going fast. As we said last week, Nicola has been out. I know that the Attic and Sassy Jacks both have them. Kim has a good supply, I think, still at Sassy Jacks. And then, as we mentioned last week, the Stitching Shop in Denver, Gulf Coast Stitches, House Tyrol Needleworks in Williamsburg, Virginia, and the Stitching Post in Catonsville. Maryland, all still, I think, have some. But supplies are they're getting sold. So if you want one, get on it and, set everything aside and do this thing with us. It's going to be fun.
It is.
And then someone, Sandra Truman Horn, if you're interested in NPI silks, I've heard more people gush over NPI silks. She posted in the Stitch Along group a conversion chart from the DMC to NPI silks. And, those look nice. So that's in the Stitch Along. You can find that. And I want to make sure that we get in. There's two giveaways affiliated with this. One is the number of colors. And you send that to me, Gary@WeTalkFiber.com. Send me the number of colors that are in the chart, one more than 22, one less than 24. Just got to put Sarah Brazier at the top and the number in the body there of the email. That's all you have to do, and we'll put you in the drawing that we will do on May 19, the day of the royal wedding, and then five people will each be able to select one Hands Across the Sea sampler chart from Nicola's little supply, which is not little. So five people will win a chart out of that. And then Nicola kind of evolved a little bit more. She has this giveaway that she'll do a drawing on May 1st of 2019. So a year from this past May 1st. And the winner of that drawing will receive the original Mary Clayton sampler. So you'll get the real deal. But the interesting thing is that the first question was, is Hands Across the Sea going to chart Mary Clayton? And she had not intended for that originally. It was going to be whoever won it would have the opportunity to chart it and sell it and, you know, make a little money off it or do whatever you want to do with it. But apparently there was enough peer pressure that Nicola caved, and Hands Across the Sea samplers is going to chart Mary Clayton. But the cool thing is, if you comply with the drawing requirements for Mary Clayton to win the sampler, everyone who complies will get a free copy of the Mary Clayton Hands Across the Sea sampler's chart.
Oh, that's nice.
How cool is that?
That's very cool.
Yeah. So, and the requirements are that you have to stitch Sarah Brazier. It has to be done by April 30, 2019. Nicholas saying midnight UK time, April 30. You have to finish, and you have to post photos of your progress throughout the year on the Stitch Along page, and then a photo of the finished product. So you have to comply with those things to be put into the drawing to win Mary Clayton. And if you do that, whether you win the actual sampler or not, you will get a chart from Hands Across the Sea. So, you know, there's incentive, because that was one of the things that we had talked about. These stitch-alongs, especially something as big as this over time, are just going to kind of peter out. So what's the challenge? Mm-hmm. Well, there's the challenge right there. In a year's time, you just got to finish this thing, and at minimum, you'll get a Hands Across the Sea sampler chart, and at maximum, you'll get an actual original sampler. So
yeah.
That's pretty neat, too. Yeah, it's pretty neat. Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. That's good. Let's see. What else did we have here? Oh, yes. Be sure, if you haven't already, to watch the video I did with Gene Lee when I was out in Phoenix a couple weeks ago, where we toured with the video. We toured the Sarah Brazier model that Jacqueline stitched that is now at the attic in Phoenix in Mesa, Arizona. We toured that and talked about it, and Jean offers some advice for stitching from her vast mind full of expertise. And I made a simple, it's a YouTube video, but I made a simple URL. It's wetalkfiber.com/SarahB. So /SARAHB. And that will take you right to the page on our website that has the video. So wetalkfiber.com/SarahB, and you'll be able to see that video. And what somebody said that they had bookmarked it, and they were going to use that to help them stitch. And
yeah.
And there was a couple people that I read that once they saw it, they weren't going to do the thing. Then when they saw that, then they decided they were going to get the chart and do the sampler. So. A lot of fun, yeah. 600 people, effectively 600 people. A lot of fun. We're building up here to just really planning to keep this going and have some something different on an ongoing basis with this thing. And a lot of people are very curious about you and your thread selections and how that's going. There is much curiosity about.
My Christine's, crazy plan.
Yeah, Christine's sparkly Sarah Brazier sampler. So
yes.
Yes. How's that going?
Well, I have to wait for linen. The plan is, what I'm going to do is get the linen. I'm going to dye it. Right now I have a little bit of just like black, just fabric, Congress clothy kind of things. What I'm going to end up doing, and I've given this quite a bit of thought of sort of how I'm going to plan it out. I'm going to take a bit of the extra dyed linen, and before I stitch anything, I'm going to take all of the threads that are the threads that are intended for the sampler, and I'm just going to do a couple of rows of cross stitch of those just to have a baseline. So I'm going to essentially create a stitch library. On very simple, simple embroidery hoop, and then couple it maybe on either side with some metallics that I think might go well or my complement. Maybe do a couple that are single strand DMC, single strand blending filament. Just basically noodle around with a bunch of different things and see what things work and what things don't. And hopefully that will give me an idea, because I don't want to do the experiments that much on the piece itself. So right. I'm going to do a lot of stitching up front ahead before I do it, because the border to me is really what's going to bring this whole thing together, especially if I'm going to do it in metallic. So that border needs to be spot on fantastic. So before I even touch that, I'm going to stitch it separately until I get those colors absolutely perfect. So there's going to be a lot of experimentation on the side, and it's not all going to be metallics. It's going to be a blend of other things. You know, it's going to be regular DMC. Some of the colors are going to have to change simply because they're on a dark background. So in order to give them, you know, to make them draw out of the fabric, they're going to have to change a little bit. But on the flip side of that, some of the paler pinks, the really light blues, those are really going to stand out and look spectacular, I think. So there's going to be a little experimentation. I'll be posting pictures the whole way through, and probably asking for lots of opinions, because I'm not really sure what's going to work. And like I said, I'm going to try things, and some things are going to work and some things are going to not work. And I'm not going to be shy about taking them out and doing something different. So we will see.
Well, it is going to be absolutely fun watching this unfold. Yep.
Yes. Yeah, for me as well.
Yep. All right. We need to wrap up. Our guest Sunday is Barbara Hudson of Queenstown Sampler Designs. And if I recall correctly, it's just Barbara and me. I think this was when you, shortly after your accident, we recorded it and you were not yes. available. So just going to hear me on Sunday, but really enjoyed talking with Barbara about the samplers and what a vast library of knowledge in her brain about samplers and a lot of American, early American samplers and what those are. So that'll be Sunday. And so if you don't hear Christine, that's just because it was recorded several weeks ago after she had her accident and she wasn't available. But yeah. So Barbara Hudson Sunday, Sarah Brazier, Stitch Along, sponsored by us and Sassy Jacks on Facebook. And only need 4 or 5 more people to hit 600. That's pretty impressive. So
jump in.
There you go. Get your charts too, because they're going to be gone soon. And that's it. Thanks for listening.
Take care.